Thank you. Please put your headphones. I'm going to speak in English. Sorry for not being able to speak in Spanish today. My turn to thank the organizers, to thank Flaxo and UCA for making this possible and for inviting us in this great space. What I will do in the next 20 minutes is to present to you the general idea behind this project, which has this very long title here. The project is called Avoiding Conflict Relapse Through Inclusive Political Settlements and State Building After Intra-State War. So I will tell you a little bit about what is the background to this project and then share some of the key concepts and the key findings from the six cases that we're looking at, and then you will hear some examples from Colombia and from El Salvador. So I will start with a few words about the background and the methodology of this project. So this research is a follow-up to two previous research projects that we have conducted together with local partners in a number of countries on the role and on the self-perceptions of armed opposition groups that have been taking part in peace processes and in post-war security transitions. And this particular project stems from the realization that there's a convergence of discourse on the subject matter of inclusive transitions between two unlike-minded communities. On the one hand, rebel movements, and on the other hand, the peace-building and the development community. So on the one hand, demands for inclusive state-society relations lie at the very heart of the political agenda that are promoted by armed insurgencies. They claim to represent excluded constituencies such as indigenous people, peasants, women, lower class, isolated regions, etc. And so what we were interested in, the key question here that we wanted to address was, to what extent do former insurgents who become state agents promote inclusionary politics? Or do they tend to replicate the exclusionary practices of the former elites that they have replaced? So that was the first key question. On the other hand, we have also realized that the concept of inclusivity is paradoxically very popular within the peace building and the development community, but heavily under-investigated in analytical terms. In recent years, international agencies such as the UK Department for International Assistance, the International Network on Conflict and Fragility, have placed inclusive governance at the heart of their post-war assistance agenda. And they have associated that with the term political settlement, which is seen as bridging the goals of peace building and state building, of stability, legitimacy, accountability, effectiveness, and resilience. But what we found was that this concept of inclusivity, which is at the heart of the agenda of that community, is used without proper definitions, without proper measurement criteria, and needs further unpacking and critical analysis. So who should be included? Why? Who decides what is sufficient inclusivity? And what are inclusive enough coalitions, inclusive enough governance? So we wanted to interrogate the assumptions which lie behind these discourses, and what are the actual effects of inclusivity on political settlements and state reform. So the two key questions here that we wanted to address were, firstly, under what conditions do inclusive transition processes lead to inclusive state-building outcomes? And the second key question is, what are the actual attributes and the actual benefits of inclusivity in terms of legitimacy, effectiveness, resilience, and stability? Uh, So this is a table that shows the six cases that we are looking at in this research. And as you can see, there's a wide variety in what they look like. In terms of chronology, three of these transitions have occurred more than 20 years ago, and they are now in a phase of democratic consolidation, peace consolidation. So that's the cases of Colombia, South Africa, and El Salvador. Three of these transitions have occurred a bit less than 10 years ago, and therefore they are still in a phase of implementation of peace building and implementation of state reform. One of these cases have relapsed into violent conflict. This is the case of South Sudan. But these cases are quite different in terms of the formats that have been used to come to try and formulate inclusive post-war political settlements, and also are quite dissimilar in terms of the outcomes. So there's one of the columns here which is about what did the decision-making arenas look like and were these inclusive or not. And so I've put this yes or no. Basically, those cases that have a no, it means that the main arena where political reforms were decided were peace negotiations. And those that are judged as national or inclusive decision-making areas, they took the form of constituent assemblies or wide national dialogues. The codification of state reform has taken the form of a new constitution in some cases, some legal reforms in other cases, and in South Sudan and in Nepal, there is still an ongoing process of constitution making. And finally, the last column shows that the former insurgents, they find themselves in positions of conducting state politics. Either they are at the heart of state power, or they are in coalitions or participating at some level in central or in local power. So this slide is describing who is taking part in this research and what does this international cooperation look like. So the project coordination is carried out by CINEP, represented here by David. CINEP is based in Bogota in Colombia. My foundation, the Bogo Foundation, is responsible for coordinating the research dimension. And then we have case study teams in each of the six contexts. So Flaxo is our partner in El Salvador, and then we have partners in South Africa, in South Sudan, in Aceh, and in Nepal. And finally, we have an advisory committee that helps us and guide our research and our findings, and these advisors come from the policy world or the research world. So there's two key terms that are underpinning this research. The first term is called, in English, the term political settlement. Political settlements are usually defined as... So political settlements are defined as an expression of a common understanding, usually forged between elites, about how power is organized and exercised in a given state. So political settlements comprise formal and also informal power arrangements. The term political is quite misleading because, in fact, these settlements, they don't only encompass political actors and political arenas, but are also strongly anchored in socio-economic arrangements and rules of the game. With regards to the relation between political settlements and conflict settlements, we found that there are some strong links. Peace negotiations and peace accords usually set the stage for carrying out structural state reform through new political settlements. And we have found some contexts where political settlements have also enabled peace processes, and we'll hear about the case of Colombia, where the process of reforming the constitution and coming out with a new constitution for Colombia has provided an impetus for the demobilization and the political participation by some guerrillas. We have defined three main stages of political settlements. So the stage of negotiation and decision making through bilateral or multilateral dialogue platforms, such as peace talks, technical committees, national dialogues, or constituent assemblies. The next stage is the stage of codification, which consists in peace accords, new constitutions, or legal reforms. And finally, the stage of materialization, which consists in the transformation of state institutions and the implementation of policy reforms and of more inclusive state-society relations. The other concept which is at the heart of this research is the concept of inclusivity. And we define inclusivity as having two key dimensions. Firstly, a focus on process, which can be defined as participation. Participation, in turn, can be said to have two dimensions, the horizontal dimension to participation and a vertical dimension. Horizontal participation means the inclusion of key actors, key stakeholders who have the capacity to implement or to spoil the peace. So basically, horizontal participation is about traditional as well as emerging post-war new elites who have economic, social, cultural, political, or capital resources and power. What we found in the project was that the best measure of horizontal inclusivity is when all key stakeholders have the possibility to be at the table, whether they use that or not, but they have the right and they have the possibility. When we talk about vertical inclusivity, we mean that larger segments of population are able to contribute to decision making. And this is specifically relevant for marginalized groups and marginalized actors who have, by tradition, by culture, or by history, limited resources and entry points to access, influence, or to participate in the power infrastructure in a given society. So this means indigenous people, women, and specific cultural, religious, or ethnic groups. And what we found is a key dilemma, which I will come back to in a minute, is that it's quite difficult to have a genuine participatory process which at the same time sustains the interests of the elites so that they don't act as spoilers of the process. We found that the criteria that have been used by the different case study authors to assess inclusivity across the different contexts, they vary within a spectrum of more conservative approaches that focus on horizontal inclusivity between old and new elites, and more emancipatory, progressive approaches that center on vertical elite society inclusion. So in some contexts, for instance, in Indonesia, it was found that, well, yes, the process was quite inclusive because all sectors of armed groups were represented. So this, again, uses the concept of horizontal inclusivity. In other contexts, inclusion was defined as the participation of the political opposition more broadly, especially progressive forces, leftist armed and non-armed actors. And in the third range of cases, the focus was on the vertical participation of marginalized communities as being the main criteria for defining and measuring inclusivity. Some dimensions which we found useful to assess the extent of especially vertical inclusivity in a given society. The first one is the distinction between participation and representation. Participation refers to an active act of involvement or engagement. Representation means that one's issues and one's concerns are interpreted and put forward and negotiated by some representatives or by third parties. And we found in the research that a genuine representation of interests by elected representatives, for instance, or by a negotiation team might be more inclusive than a fake or a symbolic participation of constituencies that in fact have no power. This brings me to my next point, which is the distinction between participation and influence. We found that participation does not, by default, translate into real and substantial influence or decision-making power. And we found that participation on equal terms is often impeded by structural, institutional, cultural, or capacity imbalance. And we refer to this presence without power as what we call internal exclusion. We found that internal exclusion is quite common in post-war or post-conflict states because broad-based participation creates uncertainty for elites, and they are inclined to shape processes that seem, that look participatory, but where only the elites can really influence the outcome. Therefore, a real participation is strongly affected by the nature of the decision-making mechanisms and whether they favor minority positions through, for instance, the qualified majority vote, minority veto rights, consensus building, having some forms of public control, public validation through referendum, etc. And the other dimension of inclusivity, which focuses on the outcome, we call that of responsiveness. So outcome inclusivity focuses on the level of representativeness and the level of responsiveness of the state towards the different sectors of society. Indicators of outcome inclusivity could be, firstly, that the composition of state institutions reflect the structure of society. Another indicator would be that major texts that codify the political settlement and their implementation are responsive with regards to the distribution of rights and entitlements across groups and classes in society. For instance, whether they put in place minority rights, whether there's a regime change from authoritarianism to pluralism, whether there's a redistribution of land and resources, etc. And we found that outcome inclusivity can be measured either objectively by examining what is the content of laws and policies, but it can also be measured subjectively by looking at what are public perceptions towards the state across social sectors, and do society's various constituent groups feel represented by power holders and consider that their concerns are being addressed by the state or not. So in the few minutes that I have left, maybe I will focus on two key findings from the project, or I would say preliminary findings, because as has already been explained, we are still in the process of gathering all of the data and making sense of that rich soup of data that we have. One of the key questions for this research was, do inclusive negotiation or dialogue processes necessarily lead to inclusive outcomes? So we wanted to compare the level of actual participation in decision-making processes on what will state reform look like and the extent to which the demands were addressed in the outcome. What we found was that there is a relation, but there is no strict causal correlation between who participates in decision-making and the content of the resulting settlements. What we found was that, as has been stated by some scholars, participation in decision-making may not be as important as the perception that the governance outcomes are relatively responsible to the needs of groups who might otherwise have the interest and the power to undermine the political settlements. So in other words, direct participation might be less important than indirect participation for a settlement to be perceived as inclusive, as long as the outcomes are accepted by non-elites as responding to their interests. Something interesting that we also tried to tackle in this research was the dilemma of effectiveness and legitimacy effectiveness of a process versus a legitimacy of the outcome. And here we looked at the potential dangers that are associated with having too much inclusivity. So there is a lot of discourse in the development community about having inclusive enough coalitions or having sufficient inclusion. So we were wondering, is there something as too much inclusivity? There is the idea that sometimes when too many actors are represented in decision making, a settlement will be harder to reach and it might lead to a compromise that is not workable. So these dilemmas were raised in the cases of South Sudan, Nepal, and Aceh, for instance. So what we tried to do was to identify possible formulas to handle this dilemma. In short, we found two possible formulas. The first one we called incremental inclusivity, which basically means that a process can start in a quite exclusive fashion, but then inclusivity might be built over the process. And basically, this means that peace accords should not be comprehensive because peace accords are not the places where inclusivity happens. They are usually negotiated between quite exclusive actors, and therefore peace accords should only be limited to setting some general parameters to be followed up by inclusive arenas where structural reform and socio-economic agendas can be negotiated and decided upon. The second formula we called thematic inclusivity, and here as well the idea is that some spaces might be less inclusive than others, and for instance, matters around security might happen in spaces that are less inclusive than negotiations around major political and structural reforms, which have to be inclusive. A third formula which we looked at is the idea of having parallel consultation channels with binding mechanisms. So basically, actors that cannot be present in the negotiation or in the decision-making space have to have some ways of influencing that process by being consulted, but through some binding mechanisms to make sure that the results of these consultations will be taken into account. And the last formula that we looked at is that of having some kind of informal deadlock-breaking mechanisms within inclusive formal arenas, such as constituent assemblies. So when you have too many actors in a formal space, you might find that bringing together a smaller group of people to deal with key deadlocks might help to address, again, this dilemma of having too much inclusivity at the expense of effectiveness. So I've just been told that I have 2 minutes left, so this is my last slide. And it deals with, what did we find to be important factors which enable an effective materialization of inclusive state reform? We found in most cases, like basically across all of the six country cases, we found that there were very inclusive political and security democratization processes. Socio-economic inclusivity was much more limited, and governance culture remained unchanged across all of the six contexts. So therefore, we found that inclusive or very progressive codifications, such as a new constitution, were often unable to alter fundamentally the power infrastructures and to redress societal inequalities. And we found that both horizontal and vertical exclusivity can be sources of conflict relapse. So here I have listed the key factors that we found to be important in making an inclusive materialization possible. So the first one is the importance of having the cooperation of traditional and regional elites. We realized that we have focused a lot in our research on opposition groups, but we needed to look at the importance of existing elites as well. These actors need to feel that their interests will be protected under a new order or under a new political settlement. Secondly, we looked at the importance of having actors that are involved in codifying new political settlements to remain involved in the longest term stages of materialization. Thirdly, we felt that the level of popular legitimacy of the elites that are leading this process is very important. So the perception of inclusivity and legitimacy of leading elites is much more important than sometimes real levels of inclusivity. I've already mentioned that. The next factor that we found important is actually the capacity to implement reforms. So sometimes actors set up unrealistic goals and they don't have the resources to carry them out, so they cannot deliver to their promises unless there is massive international financial support that is guaranteed. We also found the importance of having binding mechanisms to make sure that inclusive codified settlements will be turned into reality. We also found that it's important to have some mechanisms that maintain a continued dialogue and to enable the political settlement to be renegotiated over and over again. And finally, we found that one factor which also supports inclusive materialization is that the new elites, so in that case that would be the former rebels that become politicians or that become the state, they need to have some internal inclusivity. So they need to have a regeneration of leadership. They need to open up new spaces for participation, and they need to leave some kind of healthy space for civil society to voice its concerns and to keep a role of watchdog and to make sure that that these new leaders will stick to their promises and will implement the inclusionary agenda that they have been fighting for, like, throughout their period of struggle. I'll stop here. Thank you for your attention.